I love, love, love people pointing out when I'm wrong. I just love it because I hate people thinking that I'm wrong or that I have a blind spot and quietly judging me and not giving me the data.
I don't like that. I've been doing that for months, Chris.
I think the audience has been doing that too.
You're listening to the Startup Podcast. This is an educational episode. In-depth masterclasses about the concepts essential to building, running, and investing in Silicon Valley-style startups. Whether you're a founder, investor, or operator in a startup, you'll gain insights into the principles that power high-growth disruption the same way Facebook, Google, and Uber do it. The conversation starts now.
Hey, I'm Chris Stard.
And I'm Yaniv Bernstein. In this episode, we're going to talk through the differences between how good founders and bad founders handle things like vision and execution, bringing on investors, customer obsession, hiring and communicating to their people, taking advice, and most importantly, their own personal growth. This episode of the Startup Podcast is brought to you by Vanta. You might know that sinking feeling. You're about to land a big contract when they ask about compliance, SOC 2, ISO, PCI, Essential 8. You've just snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. Not anymore. Vanta massively accelerates your compliance efforts and allows you to get those life-changing deals back on track. Don't wait until it's panic stations, though. Get started with Vanta today. They're offering 20% off their prices just for TSP listeners. Do yourself a favor. Hit pause. Go to vanta.com/TSP. That's VANTA.com to get that 20% off. Okay, Chris, I'm really excited about this one. So I wrote a post recently on LinkedIn called Good Founder, Bad Founder. And that post itself is modeled on a very famous old post by Ben Horowitz. He's the Z in A16Z, one of the founders of Andreessen Horowitz. He wrote a very influential post called Good Product Manager, Bad Product Manager. This is a couple of decades ago now, where he talked about some of the fundamental differences in belief, in behavior, in action between good product managers and bad product managers. And people have done their own version of this for a few different roles, but I was amazed. I did some Googling. There does not seem to be a good founder, bad founder. So I've staked the claim for us here. What we're going to do in this episode, Chris, is talk through that post and really add some color and some extra context that allows you to fully understand the differences. And of course, most importantly, how you can apply them in your own startup to yourself as a founder.
I love this, Yaniv. We're usually reading through one of my posts and I have all the pressure on me. So this time I get to hear you read through yours and respond and react. So let's do it.
So the first one is good founders fall in love with a problem. Bad founders fall in love with a solution or with beating competitors or with getting rich. Bad founders forget that the path to all these things runs only through solving a real problem in a way that is delightful. Bad founders are always thinking about the exit. Good founders are so focused on building that an exit seems beside the point.
Yeah, this is a big one. The one that I'm running into most often recently, and by recently, I mean the last few years, is founders being obsessed with revenue and being obsessed with fundraising and bad advice that they've been given around those things. Yep. You need to get to revenue, or you need a subscription business model, or you need to raise capital before you can launch that thing. And I just find myself reminding founders over and over and over again that at the very early stages, pretty much everything is irrelevant unless you are solving a real problem in a real way for a real group of users and putting that solution in front of them in a way that they understand, adopt, and retain on. To the degree where I have met founders where they're like, we're about to launch a subscription model. And I'm like, fantastic. Because Chris, we really need recurring revenue. We've been told by investors and our advisors, we need recurring revenue. Great. Awesome. What does the subscription model do? What is the user subscribing to? Oh, we're not sure yet. We were thinking of some kind of community forum and discussion group or exclusive content, but we haven't quite figured that out yet. They were framing it as like, they were about to do this, like any minute now. They were about to launch this and they hadn't figured out what was behind the subscription wall. That is the clearest example that I've had where the founder is focused on the business model or on the revenue instead of on the utility and delivering value.
And of course, this goes back to a theme that we're always coming back to and that there's a recent whole episode about based on one of your posts, Chris, about the difference between a venture-backed startup and your typical small business and to a lesser extent, your bootstrapped startup. In a traditional business that needs to be effectively cash flow positive or profitable from very early on, you need to be thinking about these things right at the beginning. You need to generate the value and then monetize that value, capture that value simultaneously. But the truth is that slows you down and introduces distortions. And one of the beauties of a venture-backed model, there are certainly some big downsides, but one of the beauties is you can separate the two, right? So good founders are falling in love with, how do I deliver as much value as possible? How do I generate something where value is being thrown off to the customers, to the users, and so on? And then the act of capturing that value, of monetizing that value, can be somewhat distinct. Now, that doesn't mean that you should put no thought into how this value will eventually be monetizable. But if you're thinking straight away, okay, how do I make money out of this thing, rather than how do I solve this big problem in the world in a way that is delightful and accessible and generates real value for people, you're never going to have the sort of growth and that incredible product that makes a dent in the universe that you're trying to do. That is really the path of the venture-backed founder.
The scalable product, the product that you can sell a million times instead of the professional services product you can't sell more than once. And now the other part of this that I really resonate with, Yaniv, is the falling in love with the solution versus falling in love with the problem, of course. I've done this countless times in my career. I think everybody does it. You fall in love with the thing you want to build. And I'll speak only for myself. I have these fully formed visions in my head, these vivid waking dreams of the thing that I want to build. And I see it so clearly. I've been doing this since I was a child. I actually remember one of my earliest memories trying to describe something to my parents that I was obsessed with. It just appeared in my head. I have historically been stubbornly attached to trying to build that product and see it manifest in reality at the expense of falling in love with the problem. What pain, suffering, inefficiency, or waste have I noticed? And how might I hypothesize and test multiple different solutions to that problem? We've talked about this, of course, many times on the show, but that is the path to success, because you need to learn and iterate your way to a real solution. And it might initially start off in your head looking like a Ferrari. It might ultimately end up looking like a brick on wheels to get a lot of people from A to B.
Absolutely. The last thing I wanted to mention in this paragraph, I talked about focusing on beating competitors, on getting rich, on an exit. And there's this sense of like keeping your eyes on the prize rather than keeping your eyes on the ball. You want to keep your eyes on the ball. Eyes on the prize is actually a terrible, terrible bit of advice in life in general. Keep your eyes on the ball. Fall in love with the game, and the prizes will probably come to you only if you're not focusing on them, right? Startups that are built in a mercenary way around getting rich or beating certain competitors that are sort of outwardly focused on those things rather than inwardly focused on solving that problem, the founders are distracted. And doing startups is a pretty terrible way to get rich on average. So if that's why you're doing it, I'd suggest you find a new career.
All right. What's the next paragraph in your post?
Bad founders love to be the smartest person in the room and hire people who carry out their orders. Good founders hope to be outshone by every hire they make and relish being challenged and surprised by the people on their team. Bad founders are comfortable with mediocrity. Good founders care only about learning and love nothing better than being wrong.
Yeah, so I've got three things I want to say about this. The first is just on a personal level. I love, love, love people pointing out when I'm wrong. I just love it, because I hate people thinking that I'm wrong or that I have a blind spot and quietly judging me and not giving me the data.
I don't like that. I've been doing that for months, Chris.
I think the audience has been doing that too. And I love becoming more effective over time. And I love figuring out, oh my God, I've been doing that wrong this whole time, which is why it's not working or working well. And I just want to fast forward to the right answer as quickly as possible. And I've just observed so many people, most people, I think, who get defensive, who get upset, who get frustrated. I remember I once worked with a founder where I kind of rewrote their pitch deck for them because it was so off track that I felt giving them pointed advice wasn't going to work. And they got really upset with me. They're like, you just threw away all my work. Shortly after, actually paused the contract. He didn't want to be confronted with a different point of view. And the second thing I wanted to say about this is hiring great people. I would say the best people you can find. Most people don't look for the best people. They just kind of look for whoever's in front of them and hire opportunistically. Whereas we've had whole episodes about how to hire well and how to snipe at the best people in the world. And then the last thing I'll say, Yaniv, is I actually use this as a hiring technique. So when I'm interviewing people, if they give me a nonsensical answer to a very pragmatic question, they're obviously a bad candidate. If they give me a really solid answer, an answer that contemplates much of what we've already been thinking internally about that same problem, they're a really, really good candidate, because they don't have the benefit of institutional knowledge. They don't have the benefit of having discussed and debated the idea for hours or days. And they've still jumped to many of the right questions or conclusions. If they jump to something that I had not thought of, that is brilliant. I had never thought about that. That's a good idea too. Despite having no institutional knowledge, knowing no prep time, no collaboration time, they are fucking rock stars. Like hire them immediately. And that's one of the ways that I identify great candidates is if candidates can spontaneously come up with an idea that's better than the ones I've had, having thought through the problem.
Now, a lot of this is about ego. And again, it comes down to, are you obsessed with solving the problem or are you obsessed with something else? Are you insecure or do you love the idea that you are bringing on such an amazing team that you're no longer the person who is best placed to actually solve that problem, but that your team collectively are? They know more than you about all the things that need to happen to be successful, that they challenge your thinking, that they lift you up, that if as a founder, as a CEO, potentially, you are the person who knows the most, that is because you are standing on the shoulders of the giants who you've hired and not to be the smartest person in the room, because it's very lonely. It does not lead to the best outcomes. And the only reasons that you would hire in a mediocre way is A, because you don't care about hiring the best people, or B, because you are in some sense threatened by hiring the best people, because the best people will challenge you. They won't just take orders. I think there's certainly a huge amount of the personal growth aspect. We've had a few episodes on mental health, but you can't be insecure as a founder and need to feel like you are the person who's the smartest and in the most control.
We've said this over and over and over again. It sounds like a cliche. It sounds like a platitude. It is not. The quality of your company will be determined by the quality of your people, and the best people can execute 10 or 100 times better than even the second or third tier people. And so the best people will make the best companies, period, full stop. That's a fact. And also, if your company is not going to exit for billions of dollars or IPO because of those great people, at the very least, you want to try to land an acqui-hire. And in that case, they're buying your company for the people. And so you need a great team around you. That's part of the value creation that you are engaged in. And so you're trying to build a collection of great people who are great at solving that particular problem. So maybe at the very least, your plan B is to have that team acquired from you to make a few bucks on the way out the door.
Okay, next. Good founders pursue and protect a lofty dream with steely-eyed pragmatic execution. Bad founders cannot correctly blend the two. They either refuse to confront reality or else allow their pragmatism to corrupt and destroy their dream. I know you like this one, Chris.
I love this one. This is the balance between having a big vision and having great execution. Oftentimes, founders, people in general, are good at one or the other. Oftentimes at companies I'm advising, I'm either playing the pragmatist because the company is too visionary and too lost in the sky, or I'm playing the visionary because the company is too stuck in the weeds and in pragmatic incremental execution. And so being able to marry those two, having a big, beautiful, bold ambition that motivates and animates everything, while also being very involved in the details and the tactical execution and the pragmatism without being derailed and forked into hedging and other pathways, is such a super power. And it's such an incredible thrill when you meet people like that. It's one of the few ways to find the path to success.
I've sometimes described it as head in the clouds, feet on the ground. Too often you have people who are either like their whole body's in the clouds or their whole body's on the ground. And neither of those is going to get you to success. If you're listening to this podcast and you're worried you might fall into one of these two buckets, what you'll find is a pragmatist is like, it's all very well to talk about the big vision, but you know, reality's going to come and kill it anyway. So I may as well just focus on making a profitable business or whatnot. Now the dreamers, this is a bit more dangerous. So if you're listening to this, please pay attention. The dreamers often take solace from this sort of a message because they're like, well, I've got a big ambition. I'm a founder and I'm working hard. I've spoken to too many founders who do not accept some of the constraints and the realities that will shape their attempt to change the world and keep sort of butting their head against a brick wall. And eventually they tend to get a bit embittered. They're like, the system's rigged against me and I wasn't able to succeed. And so you have to have this brutal streak of pragmatism in your execution if you're ever going to have any chance of succeeding in your dream. So please hold yourself to that standard. Otherwise, it's a bit of a tragic waste of effort. And I hate saying that.
Yeah, the people who are obsessed with pragmatism and way over-indexed get nothing done because they triple check everything and are too concerned to make any bold bets. And people who are obsessed with a vision and ambition get nothing done because they're trying to do everything at the same time. They're both getting kind of nothing done.
The pragmatists get quite a lot done, but they end up building their technology-backed services business or whatever because they're straight away, they're settling. Whereas the dreamers, they're going to build their beautiful MVP. They have this idea for an app. They're like, I need someone to build my app and it's going to change the world. They build it and no one comes. And I think then they try again and no one comes again. And I think that's the danger for them.
Yeah, I guess I should say nothing done by definition is nothing that scales and is sustainable done. There's a lot of busy work, a lot of one-off custom stuff done, a lot of like shipping and iterating and talking to customers, but it's nothing in terms of a sustainable, scalable business growing there.
All right, so on to the next one. Bad founders are careless about their people. They hire easily and thoughtlessly, allow good performers to leave and bad performers to stay. good founders care about every role in the company being filled by the precise right person. It obsesses them. Their drive for the startup to succeed overrides their empathy for any one individual. Now, we've kind of covered some of this earlier on about the being the smartest person in the room, but I think there are a couple of extra bits of nuance to go through here. I've talked about being careless about your people. Your people are fundamentally what's going to make your startup succeed. There are two places where that really matters. One is in hiring, and then the second is in management. I said that bad founders allow good performers to leave and bad performers to stay. They bring people in, some of them might be good, some of them might not be, and then they just let everyone do their thing. And what then happens is generally the poor performers are the ones who are going to stick around. The good performers are going to look around and say, this place has a bunch of poor performers, I'm leaving. And the founders let that happen. So the ruthless streak in a good founder is that they will not allow that to happen. And that final sentence there, I said the drive for the startup to succeed overrides the empathy for any individual. Doesn't mean they don't have empathy. The best founders are very empathetic and really care about their people. But if they see that somebody is the wrong person for a role, that they're not performing, they will do something about it. Often they will let them go. And that is how you end up with a high talent density, high performing organization where the high performers, the good people, want to stick around.
Yeah, for me, the previous paragraph about people was really about hiring, about noticing someone's really smart and being almost intimidated by that or not looking for the smartest people to hire. This one is about managing and curating the people you already have, at least in my mind. It's about allowing people to languish, allowing performance to lag. And so this is about having hard conversations and really being engaged with the details of your people. I agree with you, Yaneva. You want to have empathy for people, but your empathy for your startup needs to be greater. And your empathy for the culture and community that you're building within your startup needs to be greater, which means you need to potentially fire people who aren't a fit long term.
Again, the drive for the startup to succeed overrides their empathy. In other words, you can have a lot of empathy, but you care so much about fulfilling your vision that even if you are extremely uncomfortable with some of the tough calls you need to make, you're going to make them anyway because it is that important to you.
You make them with empathy, unlike Elon Musk.
You make them with empathy, but you make them. You do not suffer from ruinous empathy. Next up, good founders focus on their customers, clearly communicate their vision and plans to investors, and take investment from others who believe in them. Bad founders will adjust their plans to please investors, placing their needs above those of customers.
Yeah, I love this one so, so much. Longtime fans of the show will know that I was going to have a big smile on my face about this one. Our favorite saying on the show, and you've probably heard us say it a few times, is you want to be a space heater, not a thermometer. One of my superpowers is having a clear vision and changing people's minds, having discipline to hold onto that vision, understanding that if people aren't immediately convinced by that vision, it doesn't mean the vision is necessarily wrong, although it might be, but rather I need to refine how I'm articulating myself. I need to create better incentives to bring people along. I need to push harder on the world and bend it to my will and before giving up that the idea is possibly a bad idea or what have you, right? And so doing this with customers, doing this with teams, doing this with engineers, doing this with investors is so, so important. I think bad product managers will often be too quick to check with engineering. Chris, I don't know if we can do that. That's a beautiful design, a beautiful idea, a beautiful intuition. My next meeting will be to check with engineering if we can do that. And I'm always quick to point out, like, wait a second, let's first figure out if we want to do this and what that might look like and what might be a series of iterations from here to there in terms of a product roadmap, firstly. And secondly, I can assure you engineering can do this. If Elon Musk can launch a rocket into orbit, have it flip around on its ass, land in the middle of the ocean, then we can make that button do that thing on our SaaS product. It's possible, yeah. I assure you. And so whether it comes down to business model debates with investors or white label or go-to-market debates with partners or implementation debates with engineering, you as a founder, you as a product manager, you as a leader need to have a clear vision for what is the ideal, engage with that vision and debate and discuss and push for that vision before collapsing like a house of cards.
Yes, I agree with everything you say. I guess I did want to focus in on this one, especially for taking on investors, because it's the one where I see people really falling apart because raising capital is scary. Most founders are first-time founders by definition, and they find the whole process quite intimidating. And they talk to investors who do this all the time, and they're like, oh no, you shouldn't focus on this metric. You should focus on that metric. You should monetize this first. No, you shouldn't be a platform. You should be a two-sided marketplace, whatever it is, right? And then people say, oh, okay, I'll change my pitch deck and make it look better, more like what investors are looking for. No, your pitch deck should not vary from what you actually believe is the right thing to do. Good sales isn't about telling untruths or about compromising your principles. Good sales, and VC pitching is, of course, the sales process, is about sharing your vision in a compelling way so that those who are excited by it self-select in. Your investors choose you because they believe in what you're doing. They're not trying to change it. And I think that's the really hard part. I was speaking to a founder whose company I've invested in yesterday, and I was really excited because he talked with an investor who was trying to make him change his focus. And he's like, so I guess I just won't. I'm not going to be interested in taking money from this investor. Not many founders have that level of confidence, and it's so important to have it.
I want to play with the phrase you just said. You said, your investors choose you because. No, you choose your investors. You choose them. You choose your customers. You choose your partners based on what you need and want for your business.
It's mutual opt-in, right? I guess the idea is you say, this is who I am. This is what I'm doing.
Yes.
If you like it, get on board. If you don't like it, no problem. Have a nice life.
Now, there is a tension between this and the previous paragraph we discussed, which is you want to be okay with not being the smartest person in the room, which means about being humble about certain things, about being open to new data, about changing your mind. There's a difference between being confident enough to not be the smartest person in the room and to update your priors and to update your plan, and having a lack of confidence in your vision. I think where people run into trouble is that somebody will say something that is unconvincing. So they're not convinced by the investor or the customer or the salesperson or the engineer that that is a bad idea and they should change direction. But they'll do white label anyway. They'll change their business model anyway. I can't tell you how many founders I've worked with where there's like, the VC said we should change to B2B. I think it's dumb. I want to do B2C, but we just had to do it, Chris. You don't understand. Yeah. And I'm like, you compromised and corrupted on your vision. You were not convinced by a smarter person that this is a better plan, you just collapsed. Yeah. And so that's the difference between clear vision and being confident enough to change your mind because of other smarter people.
Well, actually, I've got a paragraph on my post exactly about that. You kind of already covered it. Bad founders change their mind every time they hear a new opinion or never change their mind at all. Good founders listen carefully to the views of others, but always form their own conclusions. And I think that's pretty much what you were just saying, Chris.
Yeah, look, and the other thing I always tell product managers, but also CEOs and founders, is that the goal, the exercise is triangulation. Collecting all the data, and not just analytics, but market data and strategy data and intentionality and vision and everything, and triangulating a course of action that is the most effective one. Not compromising, but triangulating. And so it isn't about any one data point, one opinion, one advisor, one investor. It's about formulating for yourself the truth. And so, we've covered this in a few different ways. And so hopefully it's clear.
Have the openness to listen and change your mind. Have the courage of your own conviction to make your own choices, right? This episode of the Startup Podcast is brought to you by Vanta. The team at Vanta are passionate about helping you secure your business by vastly cutting down on the time to get compliant with frameworks like ISO 27001, SOC 2, and Essential 8. Vanta lets you close deals, sleep better at night, and get back to building your product. Help yourself and help the podcast by going to vanta.com/TSP for an exclusive 20% off deal. Okay, good founders know that soft skills are hard and that good communication is a core part of their job. Bad founders think that communicating with their team is a waste of time. Bad founders want to be in every room to make the right decisions. Good founders create a culture where the right decisions are made, even when they aren't in the room.
So there's this kind of balance to be struck between providing lots of context, providing lots of clarity, lots of clear OKRs or goals or KPIs and outcomes that you're driving for, and providing micromanagement at every decision in every meeting all the time. It's about good communication. I agree, Yanev. Good encapsulates the idea of the right abstraction of communication, the right framing, rather than making every decision for everyone all the time.
This is about making yourself scalable and leveraging yourself. This is one of those funny things where letting go of ego, of having to be the smartest person in the room, actually makes you much more impactful and much more scalable. Because what a superpower to say, I don't need to be in the room because my thinking is in the room even when I'm not. That I am able to act from a distance without having to be there. And it's super powerful. I think this is one of those things where, because at an early stage, and we'll get to this in a moment, you have a small team, things don't need to be scalable yet. It's easy for the founder to just be in a mode of, well, of course I'm in every room. There's only three of us, so I'm making all the decisions. But what you're not doing then is then building the muscle, building the culture within your team such that as it grows, you can easily let go. You become the bottleneck because you always have to be in the room. And that happens because you think it's not important to communicate the context, to communicate the strategy, communicate the plans, to communicate your way of thinking, to communicate the priorities to everybody, to build team cohesion and all of these things, right? You just want to be like the founder is the brain and everyone else is just sort of like the dumb drones that carry out the brain's orders. That is not scalable. That does not lead to the best results. You're right, Chris. It is related to the being the smartest guy in the room thing. It is also fundamentally about scalability and about what the role is of a founder, of a leader. Yes, there's a lot of hustle. There's a lot of direct execution that a founder needs to do, especially in the early days. As time goes on, that becomes less and less of their job. And if you don't start planting the seeds early, if you don't start realizing that your job is more than just getting shit done, then you're never going to build a scalable culture.
Part of the reason that I love startups and I love my advisory work is because I'm a little bit obsessed with scale and leverage.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that includes being able to amplify my impact across a company as much as amplify my company's impact across the world. Being able to affect people while I'm not in the room, both in the company and across the world by leveraging the company itself. So if you think about it as like, if you're trying to create a company to affect the world, you also want to create a structure within your company that can affect the company. It's a fractal. You make the company itself scalable so that you can affect people when they're not in the room at the company, so that the company itself is scalable and its impact is scalable so you can affect the whole world without you personally being in there as a services business. I'm also reminded of just a funny quote, which is if you want something done fast and maybe done scalably, give it to a lazy person because they'll find the shortest path to do it so they don't have to be in the room all the time.
There was a German general called, it's a great name, Kurt Freiherr von Hammerstein Eckwart. He was a Weimar general, not a Nazi. He conceived a classification scheme for officers. This is one of the things he's most famous for, which is like a sort of a classic four square, but I'll read it out to you because it's quite funny apart from anything else. So this is for officers. He says, I distinguish four types. They are the clever, hardworking, stupid, and lazy officers. Usually two characteristics are combined. So in other words, it's your classic lattice. Some are clever and hardworking. Their place is the general staff. The next ones are stupid and lazy. They make up 90% of every army and are suited to routine duties. Anyone who is both clever and lazy is qualified for the highest leadership duties because he possesses the mental clarity and strength of nerve necessary for difficult decisions. One must beware of anyone who is both stupid and hardworking. He must not be entrusted with any responsibility because he will always only cause damage.
That's great.
He's certainly lazy, bro.
Yes, I am definitely lazy. The only part that's in question is whether I'm clever. So I like that very much.
Yeah, that one always just really resonated with me and so wittily written as well. So again, in a sense, like we're sort of front running some of these because it mirrors my own thought process in writing this. Bad founders run their startup the same way when it is 100 people as when it was 3 and expect their team to somehow make that work. Good founders understand that their role fundamentally changes when their team grows and that it is up to them to change and make it work. They understand that they have to earn their place in their role as much as everybody else in the team, more in fact.
Yeah, this one's a good one. You know, we've talked on episodes about scaling your org with Ahmad from Mercury. We've talked about preparing your org for scale in some of our earliest episodes. We've talked about this idea that pretty much for every doubling, you have to rethink the way the company works and the way people interact with each other. So when you add a second person, you have to think about how you coordinate with them. And when you add the fourth person, the eighth person, and certainly when you get to tens and tens of people, hundreds of people, a lot of the work I do is helping companies that have gotten into the hundreds, but are still acting in kind of monolithic engineering orgs and monolithic product orgs and monolithic marketing orgs and helping them break into squads and missions and teams. These transformations are often done a little too late after there's a great deal of pain, after founders realize, hang on, I've hired so many people and yet our productivity has not improved at all. In fact, perhaps it's gone slower and there's more indecision. And this really comes down to poor leadership, poor org design, poor ways of working, poor clarity in terms of what roles exist where and what they do.
To me, this comes down to personal growth and understanding that just because you are the CEO or the founder, your title doesn't change, your role completely changes, and it's up to you to grow with your role. Otherwise, you're holding the company back. You mentioned Imad. I will certainly flatter him by saying that he's a very good founder. From that conversation, everything he said, how he appeared, the fact that, again, he's a founder of a fast-growing unicorn, rumored to soon become a decacorn, a $10 billion valuation. And he seems pretty chill and relaxed. He can come on podcasts. And that is because he has built a scalable organization that he has grown with as a CEO. He's not in every room making decisions. He's hired great people and he's created a scalable organization such that his business runs whether he is in the room or in a recording studio. And that is definitely a good founder, right? Mercury was a small company not that long ago and now it's not very small. And Imad's role has changed a lot. And Imad has just changed himself, his style, how he spends his time with it. And I think that is really admirable and it's not easy. We've focused in on mental health a few times lately, and I think it's important. And, you know, one of the things that really struck me about Imad is how he presented as someone who was, I guess I'd say, relaxed, despite the fact that he is obviously incredibly driven, incredibly skillful in building this incredible startup, this incredible company, Mercury. Doing things this way and scaling yourself, leveraging yourself in the way that we've been discussing, it allows you to stay sane much more easily than running around and having to be the only person who makes all the decisions, who has to always be in the room.
Yeah, this might be just because I've shifted my focus recently, but I'm noticing a shift in the culture. We're moving from this place of admiring crazy busyness to admiring passive income and lifestyle and balance. And I think that's partly because I've shifted my focus, and I think it's partly because of COVID and the world has shifted its focus. I think as a founder, you have to disabuse yourself of this mirage of passive income and work-life balance to some degree. But you do have to recognize there's only a few things that really matter at any given time. And to not pride yourself on how just run off your feet busy you are versus how strategic and clear-minded you are about what you're working on and how you're solving that particular problem. So I don't mean for a second that you want to quit your job and become a social media influencer living in some lifestyle tech hub in the middle of nowhere until you've made it. But you do want to let go of the sense that if I'm busy, I'm being successful. You want to be productive and impactful with the time you do spend on your startup.
That's right. The very best founders make it look easy. And that's not because it's easy, but because they are spending their time on the right things. Okay, so the final paragraph I'd written is this. Good founders and bad founders both care about keeping their startup alive, but only good founders remember that it needs to have something worth living for. So yeah, it's slightly obscure perhaps, but I think this is sort of the important thing to remember, right? And this comes back to know the game you're playing. So many bad founders are so obsessed with just keeping the lights on day after day that they forget why they're doing it in the first place. And of course, you cannot succeed if you're not alive, but you can certainly, as a founder in your startup and as a person, honestly, like to start reflecting through my own midlife crisis, you can certainly stay alive and not achieve anything that is what you set out to do. And so a good founder never compromises that long-term goal just for the sake of staying alive.
The phrase we've been using a lot is knowing what game you're playing. Mm-hmm. But you can say that in a few different ways, knowing what your real goal is, knowing clearly what your vision is. And as we've said many times, you know, the goal of a Silicon Valley style startup is scale and growth and impact. It's not to stay alive. It's not to win an opportunity that is like in front of you right now today. It is about that scale. It's not about revenue. Not in the short term. It's not about revenue. It is about scale and growth. I just don't care what everybody else says. If what you're doing is not scalable, not repeatable, then you are heading down a dead end path. And so what that means is your lights might be on, but you can't find a path to scale, to growth, to that hockey stick curve. You've found meddling success. And if your goal is a venture-backed, venture-scale outcome, and you're not on that path, then you are taking the wrong kind of opportunities and engage in the wrong kind of enterprise. And so recognize that. Now, you might choose to switch gears and say, I've created a great little lifestyle business here. Maybe I can put in a different CEO, let them run it while I retire on a beach to Bali. Maybe I can have a base hit, have $5, $10, $20 million outcome, and that's life-changing for my family and walk away. But don't pretend that you're doing the other thing. Trying to raise capital and trying to split the difference, trying to hedge and so on. Just understand the real goal and be diligent and disciplined about following that.
So that was the post and our commentary on it. And hopefully that gives you a better sense of the texture of when you look at a founder, you know, what's the difference between a good one and a bad one? Founders listening out there, nobody wants to be a bad founder. This is not an easy game to play. And maybe recognizing some of those things in yourself, you're like, damn, am I the bad founder? And you want help to make sure that you are the best founder you can be. Well, I've got news for you. Chris is the person to help you get there. So Chris, if folks want to work with you, how can they do that?
Actually, a lot of what we talked about today really reminds me about the book I wrote, which I've been hesitating to talk about on the show for a little while, but at theleadershiplens.com, you actually touch on maybe 5 or 6 out of the 19 aspects of good leadership that I cover there. I've been helping startups, scale-ups, and large enterprises think through some of these great leadership characteristics, whether you're a founder or otherwise. So if you'd like to learn more about that, subscribe to my newsletter over at chrissard.com/newsletter. Or learn about my advisory work at chrissard.com/advisory.
Absolutely. Now, the other thing, folks, is Chris has actually got some compromising photos of me that were taken in a vulnerable point, and he has threatened to release them onto the internet unless more of you honor the Startup Pact, unless we get more 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. So please, for the sake of my own sanity and my own health, please honor the Startup Podcast Pact. Otherwise, Chris will be bad. So as a reminder, what we need you to do, if you are listening to this show, getting value out of it, you have committed implicitly to following us in your favorite listening app, writing us a review in your podcast listening app, following us on YouTube, and giving us a shout out on your favorite social network. Things are getting real here, folks. I need your help.
Now we're going to have to sustain this crazy scenario every episode and get people to listen all the way to the end of hear what insanity is going on.
That's right.
But no, guys, like very honestly, though, these reviews, these shout outs on social media, they're one of the main things that keep us motivated. We just love hearing that we've impacted people, that we're scaling, that we're helping founders be better. And so please keep the shout outs coming. They mean so, so much to us. And thank you so, so much to the people who've done it. They've shared such kind, effusive praise, and it really means a lot to us. We know your names. We share screenshots in the chat in our back channel with the production team. So we're seeing you and we're hearing you. So thanks so much for that. All right, Yanev, this was another fun one as always. Thanks for writing that post. It was really useful.
Thank you, Chris. It was a great discussion.
This episode of the Startup Podcast was brought to you by Vanta. Vanta helps businesses get and stay compliant by automating up to 90% of the work for the most in-demand compliance frameworks. With over 200 integrations, you can easily monitor and secure the tools your business relies on. Head to vanta.com/TSP for 20% off their incredible offering and start unlocking extra revenue today.